Hi, this is Willie Nelson from Normal. For 30 years, Normal has provided a voice for the millions of Americans who smoke marijuana responsibly. More than 500,000 Americans are arrested each year for smoking pot. These are ordinary citizens like you and me whose lives and careers are being needlessly destroyed. To learn how you can help, contact Normal at www.norml.org or call toll-free at 888-67-NORML.
Distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. This is your daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular audio podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about the show at our website, normalaudiostash.com. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. Welcome back to the Audio Stash. Today, it's Wednesday, August 8th. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Take a moment to join us at Normal right now today to help end senseless marijuana prohibition in America. We can do it together, folks. Just join or donate to Normal today at norml.org. Our lucky listeners who won a hidden stash, that's hidden stash number 3 from the Cottonmouth Kings CD and DVD sets, have received their winner notification emails. If you entered into the Cottonmouth Kings CD giveaway earlier this week on Monday, make sure you check your email and send us your address so that we can send you your CD. If you were chosen as a winner and you don't get back to us in 48 hours, we've got to choose somebody else. We got to send these CDs out the door, folks. Also, you still have a slight chance today until midnight tonight to win the Urban Cowboy t-shirt. So send in those emails to freestuff@normalaudiostash.com with Urban Cowboy in the subject line. You can be put into the drawing for the Urban Cowboy t-shirts. Just a few more days till the Austin Freedom Fest kicks off in beautiful Austin, Texas on Friday, August 10th. Make sure you get your tickets now. There's still a few available. Just go to austinfreedomfest.org to get your tickets online. Tomorrow in the Audio Stash, we're going to speak with Carolyn Wonderland, play some of her tunes here on the program. She'll be on stage at the Austin Freedom Fest. We'll also get a chance to speak with Josh at Texas Normal. He's based right there in Austin. We're going to hear a little bit more about the venue itself and hear about what Texas Normal is doing down there. Today in the Audio Stash, we've got Dr. Mitch Earlywine for our weekly Cannabis Science segment. We also have a very special guest for you today. Valerie Corral is the founder of the Women's Alliance for Medical Marijuana, or WAM. They'll be one of the beneficiaries of the Austin Freedom Fest on Friday. Valerie has really been one of the pioneers of medical marijuana in this country and one of the most vocal and strongest fighters for this cause. Valerie will be there for the Austin Freedom Fest this week, but we'll get a chance to speak with her today about WAM, the Women's Alliance for Medical Marijuana, and her husband's work in Santa Cruz. So Valerie Corral here on the program today, but first let's get to our Cannabis Science segment with Dr. Mitch Earlywine. Wednesdays here on the Audio Stash, we get the chance to discuss the science of cannabis with Dr. Mitch Earlywine. Mitch is professor of psychology at State University of New York. He's author of Understanding Marijuana, A New Look at the Scientific Evidence, and editor of the new book, Pot Politics. You can catch Mitch's new column every month as well in High Times magazine. We have links to his books at normalaudiostash.com. Mitch, welcome back to the show today.
Oh, thanks a lot.
Great to speak with you today, Mitch. Now, in America last week, we were all confronted with the late summer reefer madness propaganda in the media again. Last week, it was a report that one joint equals 5 cigarettes when it comes to things like tar. Now, Mitch, you had an editorial published on this very topic this week in the Albany Times Union newspaper. We have links to that article at normalaudiostash.com. But, Mitch, is it true at all that one joint could equal 5 cigarettes when it comes to all that bad stuff in the smoke?
It's so hilarious when you think about it, Chris, because when you look at just what are the chemicals in marijuana and what are the chemicals in tobacco, they're pretty much even on all the really nasty components. When this five cigarette thing got started was they were comparing tar deposited in lungs, and it was with, you know, people taking these big lung buster hits and holding them for a long time, and of course that does give crud in the smoke an opportunity to get deposited in the lungs. For what it's worth, James Zachney did a study where he had folks either blow their hits out pretty much immediately or hold them up to 20 seconds and found that, in fact, the impact on subjective intoxication on the high was not all that meaningful. And then he got people to say they were more high holding their breath for 20 seconds when they were smoking placebo pot, which makes me think, hey, maybe this holding your breath thing is really unnecessary, and it definitely does increase the amount of tars that are deposited in the lung. But then as you look further at this article, you realize that the results were only comparable to up to 5 cigarettes on one of the measures that they used. They had all kinds of measures of airflow, of how much can you force air from your lungs and things along those lines, and it was nowhere near 5 times as much for the cannabis smokers as it was for the tobacco smokers. And so I feel like this is yet another case where, you know, the original research gets misrepresented by the press, and suddenly we're all hearing warnings about how we're all going to develop respiratory problems when, in fact, it's really not the case. And then, you know, anybody who listens here regularly knows that my vaporizer soapbox is ready when I can climb on that and beg everybody to use a vaporizer instead of smoking.
You also noted Dr. Donald Abrams' data that those who use a vaporizer are not exposed to toxic gases. And we've extensively covered Dr. Donald Tashkin's data here on the Audio Stash. That data found no increased risk for lung cancer in lifetime cannabis smokers. But in regard to Dr. Tashkin, years ago, he himself thought there might be some lung cancer risk, and then, through his exhaustive scientific study, he proved himself wrong.
Over a decade ago, he found some odd respiratory cells inside the lungs of cannabis smokers, and he thought, hey, looks like these are probably precancerous, they're going to turn into tumors. And then a 10-year follow-up, of course, they didn't. Bob Malamud, who I know has been on the show before, has explained that THC actually has some activity that may be dampening some of the tumor formation, whereas nicotine has quite the opposite effect. So here you have, you know, pretty much the same chemicals in the smokes, but these key ingredients, THC and nicotine, really accounting for the big difference as far as lung cancer is concerned.
There really is no similarity between those two chemicals. I mean, nicotine we know to be very toxic, and THC is essentially non-toxic.
Oh, I mean, the lethal dose for nicotine is something to really be concerned about, particularly folks who, you know, use it as a pesticide, which is used as commonly, as opposed to, you know, you can imagine spraying THC on your plants and obviously nothing would happen.
Talk about Miracle-Gro. Now, Mitch, in an interview we conducted with Dale Gehringer about effective cannabis and the THC delivery systems, we know that the vaporizer really is the absolutely safest and most effective. But the old-fashioned rolled joint, that's pretty darn effective as well. In fact, Dale pointed out that the joint was better than a pipe or a water pipe bong when it came to efficient THC delivery.
Dale's data are actually really compelling, and it's the key issue is the ratio of THC to tars and other nasty components, and the joint's ratio for that is really good. The joints aren't great for cooling the smoke, and so that was why so many people, you know, jumped to the ice-filled bong and things along those lines. And even though THC isn't water-soluble, unfortunately, the bong seems to trap some of the THC in the water. So you end up not getting as good a ratio of THC to tars as you do in the standard joint.
Now, I have to kind of ask this funny question here, but what about just holding your breath without any smoke or vapor? I mean, Mitch, just sitting down and holding your breath, that will kind of give you a head rush as well.
I hate to say how much of my grade school time was spent doing that. I mean, you can really hyperventilate and hold your breath and make yourself basically pass out. I mean, it's insane. And I think people kind of forget that when they you know, are spending their time holding these big lung buster hits, that really most of the change in intoxication experience is from holding your breath, not from any kind of increased absorption in THC.
Okay, so again, here the headlines and media coverage was alarmist at best and at worst some misinformed propaganda out there. One joint does not equal five cigarettes in tar or anything else. But we also know that daily marijuana smokers do have some coughing, perhaps wheezing or phlegm production, but those things are certainly not diseases, and they certainly won't kill you the way cancer or emphysema will, and those things we know cigarettes cause.
Well, and, you know, thanks to the Marijuana Policy Project, I've got money to give vaporizers to these folks, and I just ran the first two participants in the vaporizer study, and they're daily users, and they're going to be using their vaporizer every day for a month, and we're going to see if these symptoms improve, and I'm extremely optimistic that that's going to turn out okay.
So the premise here is that those who smoke cannabis every day who already may have that coughing or phlegm production, that using a vaporizer will actually make those minor symptoms go away for daily cannabis consumers?
That's what I'm testing, but it seems like it should work theoretically. When you look at the output of the vaporizer, there's literally nothing but cannabinoids in that mist. There's hardly any detectable concentration of any of the tars and stuff that you see in smoke or even in some of the smoke that comes out of the water pipe.
And are these test individuals using the Volcano vaporizer?
No, I couldn't afford that, so we're actually turning to one of the other models.
Aha, the Volcano, a bit too luxurious a ride for the everyday researchers there.
The BMW, as the Germans call it.
Indeed. Now let's use our paddle shifters to switch gears here for a moment today, Mitch, because there are a number of events coming up. This Friday is the Austin Freedom Fest with Willie Nelson asleep at the wheel at Carolyn Wonderland and others. That venue holds 5,200 people. The Seattle Hemp Fest is the biggest reform rally in the United States with a couple hundred thousand folks at Myrtle Edwards Park in Seattle. That's coming up the following week. And then there's the Boston Freedom Rally in September, as well as some other events. Mitch, you know, let me ask about the broader importance of these gatherings. Do they spur further action and really get folks more involved?
You know, Chris, we see in the social psychology literature time and again that the social proof notion of being around folks who are in your in-group can really have some positive effects when it's later time for you to reach out to folks who aren't on your side. It's easy when you're the lone legalizer in your town to feel like you're really all alone, and hooking up with even a dozen people would give you such a good feeling, and then suddenly we're getting into the thousands. I can't even explain it. The bliss that you can experience being around all these other people who are very much on the same path as you, trying to get what is just seems like a complete civil rights issue into the minds of other folks. And it's funny how you'll leave something like this so excited and much more willing to talk to folks who you don't know or who you're not sure where they stand on this issue, and find out that in fact almost everybody is on the side of medical cannabis, and more people are willing to entertain the idea that maybe an adult should be allowed to own whatever plants he or she wants. And it's so interesting how we've got literature on very small groups in experimental laboratories. In big groups, it's just a multiplication of that effect. It's really wonderful.
And do people's individual psychology change a bit within these large groups? I mean, do you actually feel more free when you're in attendance?
Well, what's interesting is we've seen that go in two directions. And for the good, it's an opportunity to be more open, more out, more disinhibited in general, particularly when everybody's behind the same social cause. Unfortunately, we've seen this go awry in, you know, soccer games where two countries decide to, you know, declare war on each other after a game or something like that. And that de-individuating, that losing identity in the group can be a bad thing, but it can really be a very good thing in that joining sense. And we see it often in organized religion or in big events like these, where suddenly people realize they've got more in common than they have not in common, and that's where the identity really takes a big boost.
And how about further afield from the cities where these events are taking place? You know, when the general public hears that a couple hundred thousand people gathered in support of marijuana reform in Seattle, or 5,000 people came out to support reform in Texas. What kind of impact can that have on people who are far away from the event itself?
Again, it helps increase this notion of social proof. So suddenly you realize there are this many people who care about this so much that they hauled their butts down to Texas or out to Seattle to participate. That makes it more of a normative thing, if you will. Clearly, this isn't as rare as the media may make us think sometimes. Now, I'm really curious because in the past, I've seen events like this covered, and they take a picture when things are breaking up, and they make it look like there really weren't that many people there, and they pitch these underestimates about turnout and things like that, or they don't even cover it at all, and then suddenly everybody gets a little bit deflated. But I think if we talk about how that's going to happen beforehand, we'll be, you know, stealing ourselves away from that and really, you know, giving honest reports from people who were there about how many people were there and how much fun it was and how you really felt like something part of something bigger than yourself.
So even if you can't attend these events, it's important to support them and the groups that stage them, like Washington Normal and HempFest, so that the events can continue and continue to grow.
Well, and even just sending emails around to your pals who were within 50 miles of those places, because it's funny how people who you wouldn't anticipate being interested in these kinds of things actually will end up showing up if they know about them.
Right on, Mitch. Well, again, this has been a wonderful discussion here today. I really appreciate you taking time to join us each Wednesday, Mitch. Already looking forward to speaking with you next week.
Oh, my pleasure.
Thank you again, Mitch. Dr. Mitch Earlywine is professor of psychology at State University of New York. He's author of Understanding Marijuana, A New Look at the Scientific Evidence, and editor of the new book, Pot Politics. We have links to those books at normalaudiostash.com. You can also check out a column every month, Ask Dr. Mitch, in High Times Magazine. Stay tuned. Coming up next is our interview with the director and co-founder of the Women's Alliance for Medical Marijuana in Santa Cruz, Valerie Corral.
You're listening to Normal's Daily Audio Stash.
Joining us next today is one of the true pioneers of medical marijuana use and access in the U.S. Valerie Corral co-founded WAM, the Women's Alliance for Medical Marijuana, based in Santa Cruz, California. WAM is one of the beneficiaries of the Austin Freedom Fest on Friday and continues to be a leader in the methods and practice of compassionate medical cannabis access in California. Valerie, thank you so much for taking time to join us here today.
Thank you so much.
Well, it is wonderful to speak with you today, Valerie, and I'm sure you're looking forward to Friday and the music under the big sky there in Texas.
The opportunity for all of us to hear some of the greatest music around and to be a party, you know, part of the recipient of the kindness and generosity of Willie and the crew.
Indeed. And Willie Nelson, he's been a longtime supporter of the Women's Alliance for Medical Marijuana, or WAM. Valerie, tell us about the group and how it began.
It initially began out of my own illness and an unresolvable effect. I was in a car accident at a rather young age with an airplane, of all things, and became epileptic, sometimes as many as 5 grand mal seizures a day. And the treatments that were available and are still available render some 25% of epileptics still having seizure activity, so that they just simply don't work. And lo and behold, my husband Mike read in a medical journal in the early 70s and this kind of research was quashed by the Nixon administration, but in the early 70s, research was being done, and quite successfully in laboratory-induced seizures in rats, that marijuana could treat or reduce the symptoms of seizure onset. Well, you know, we really didn't believe it, but I was at this crossroads where I had to make a decision about my life, whether I was going to stay using the pharmacopoeia, the drugs of the pharmacopoeia, which didn't work, and or try to seek some alternatives. And so, I truthfully used both, but I soon found within weeks of beginning a marijuana regime, a very precise and exacted regimen, that marijuana started to reduce the seizures, and I was amazed. So in the early 90s, after 20 years of using marijuana, Mike and I were arrested for using, for growing 5 marijuana plants, and I was the first patient to bring forth a medical necessity defense in California, and guess what? You know, we won, and that brought patients to us, other people who were sick and dying, asking, could we help them? And, you know, when you've been sick and you realize that, you know, the second person who called us had lost his home, his car, and he was selling his jewelry, not just for marijuana, but because of the illness and insurance problems and co-pays. And eventually, you know, marijuana was $300-$400 an ounce at the time. And so he was selling things to buy marijuana, and we started our collective in 93, which is a free organization. Our members don't pay for marijuana. They donate, and if they can and if they're able. Everybody works if they can, if they're able, or their caregivers do. We grow in a collective garden, and we give away marijuana. In 2002, we were arrested by the DEA. And, you know, the thing about it is we haven't stopped our work. Why not? Well, because with that arrest, there was no quelling of suffering. Not one person lived longer. As a matter of fact, several of our members died quite soon after the raid because of the lack of marijuana that we had. Oh, at least we feel it contributed to their demise. We have not stopped our work because people who are sick and people who are facing death do not necessarily falter in the face of government. Even a very dark and nasty regime that's in power now. But we recognize that no matter your political line, no matter your belief system, everybody faces suffering and everybody dies. And it's that in itself is a great equalizer. So we help each other. We're even at the deathbeds. WAM is not just about marijuana. That's one of the things we do. But we take care with one another. We meet on a weekly basis. We don't smoke at our meetings. We work together. We have potluck. Tonight's our dinner theater. And once a month we do that. And albeit it's not the caliber of performing that you'll see this weekend, but it's us being together, laughing together, working together. 190 of our members have died in 14 years. It's serious, beautiful work. It's a work of living and living into dying. So we're very pleased and very honored to be thought of in such a kind and generous way by Willie and, you know, and the community there in Austin. So we're stoked.
Righto. Well, I know the people of Austin are stoked to support WAM and the other recipient groups as well. Valerie, your work has created a close relationship with the city government in Santa Cruz. If you would, tell us a bit about that relationship and the feel of the government itself there in that city.
Well, you know, we sort of think of Santa Cruz as an island, somewhat like San Francisco in as much as its political bent. The reason I say that is it's folks here have a feeling that government should stay out of our bedrooms, stay out of our blood, stay out of our urine, stay out of our health care, unless it's to really offer health care. And because what we see is that people are not well cared for. Health care is a mess in this country. People lose their homes. 22 of our members have become homeless, not because they wanted to retch out of their tents while they're doing chemotherapy, honestly, but because of the difficulty in maintaining their normal lifestyle. Ill people become marginalized, and we're a separate community. We don't want to be, but when you're dragging around your club foot or your chemo bag, you don't get to go bowling with pals, you know. You don't get to ride your scooter or your horse or whatever. So what happened is we, after the 2002 DEA raid in our community, our members locked the DEA in after they had taken us away. They found out about it. We have kind of 24-hour plans in place at all times for any kind of emergency, even if it's picking up somebody's kid or helping out cooking or helping someone through the portal of death. But they locked the DEA in, bartered for our release, and our city government was so outraged that we were able to conduct a kind of a small giveaway, a replica of what we do each Tuesday night at our WAM meetings in town in Santa Cruz. And we gave away medicine on the steps of city halls with our city fathers and mothers and friends and families and the county supervisors standing by, many, many different assemblymen and other politicians and police were in their aloha shirts being, you know, carefully guarding any problem. And the DEA helicopters overhead. But, yeah, they supported us, and we formed a lawsuit against the federal government, which just again has begun actually the day after I was asked to speak before Congress on medical marijuana. The day following, we were back in federal court bringing our lawsuit for injunctive relief, damages, and our claim against the federal government that we may just be able to continue to grow our medicine in peace, to give it away. As I say, we don't sell it, we don't buy it. It's not what we do. So it's really quite a remarkable relationship that's been formed not out of... Now, great things don't come from government down. They come from the people, right? It's the people. It's us. We're the ones who make change. And it's through our demand and our insistence. But our city and our county have responded by both joining our lawsuit. Why? Because they feel the pulse of the people and because they themselves have had experiences watching their loved ones die, their family members die. That changes us significantly. I mean, I think there are different ways to learn compassion. One is through your own suffering, and another, another is to experience suffering. And whether you witness it, or that's your experience, or your direct experience through feeling the pain, can really breed a kindness and compassion toward other people.
Valerie, it is just so moving to hear about your work. I know almost 85% of the patients at WAM are terminally ill. Now, why do you think it's so important for the most seriously ill patients, the terminally ill patients, to have access to cannabis for medical use right now?
Well, our hope, and one of the things that we've seen repeatedly, is that if people can live long enough, live well enough, then perhaps they'll be able to take another treatment, another chemotherapy. We're not trying to push the pharmacopoeia aside. We recognize the value in allopathic medicine, of course. And you know, you want your hospital nearby, and you don't want to have them rolling a joint and blowing it in your face. You want the medicine that you need to be expedient and to be quick, to lessen suffering immediately, and to move us toward whatever healing might be possible. But for folks who are dying, there's not enough time to wait for the law to change. You have this moment, and you make a choice about how we make a choice about how we deal with this moment and who we serve. Honestly, we'd love to serve everybody, because if we could influence the buyers clubs, which, you know, we're the longest running medical marijuana organization in the nation, 14 years. If we could inspire in buyers clubs to take a little bit of their profit out, you know, not be so corporate, and not put money before or equal to human life, we would change the view of marijuana in this nation. We would change it. But because many, now I'm not saying all buyers clubs do this, but for the most part, there's a great deal of money to be made. A lot of dealers and growers say, don't legalize it. We want our millions, you know, change it after. The point is that in any revolution, the revolution begins in our consciousness, within the confines of who we are. As we think, so it is. Without changing the way that we look at the world and the way that we walk in the world, without that action stemming from looking deep within ourselves, the way that we think, our consciousness, we cannot make great changes. I mean, in my opinion, nothing's doomed. You know, doomed, what is that? You know, for thousands of years we've been killing each other and acting like monkeys, maybe a little less than monkeys. You know, but what we have to have the hope. We have to know that by witnessing suffering and witnessing that we can change, quell suffering, or alleviate it, And practice for the moment of our own deaths by being present at other people's, by recognizing that this happens to all human beings. It does not matter how Republican you are. You can't get away from what lay ahead, which is the obvious passage from this life into the next. I've been at the bedside of more than 100 people. Nobody's taken a dollar with them. It hasn't mattered. It hasn't mattered. So what we hold true, in my opinion, should be that which really lasts. That's loving kindness and caring for not only ourselves, for ourselves and for others. And there's a lot that we can do to change the world by working to change ourselves and then being willing to risk. You have to risk. You got to be able to risk your freedom in order to hold your freedom, to maintain your freedom. Because if you aren't, it's being swept away every day. Maybe we don't notice that. You know, maybe that's silly. But it isn't. We just need to talk with each other. We just need to keep the conversation going and join together. This has to be more than one of us, or they'll take us out. You know, certainly if it wasn't for our kind attorneys, for the DPA, for Bingham McCutcheon, for the ACLU, Jerry Ullman as Dean of Law at Santa Clara University, and Ben Rice as a friend, criminal attorney in Santa Cruz, we'd just be more people in jail and caught up in the drug war. But we're not only that. We are caught up, but we have a voice now because of we held together in unity. And even while people were afraid, we were arrested on a Thursday. Tuesday night, we were back giving away medicine. People were afraid that night, but there were never so many WAM members. There were probably almost every WAM member that there was, almost 200 people, filled our tiny little hall. Of course, we broke the law. I know there weren't supposed to be 200 people in there, but in any case, there we were, and people talking about what are we going to do, how are we going to protect you, because really they were only after Mike and me. And they think we're, I don't know what they think we are, but certainly they know that we're not what they thought we were. I mean, you know, the day that we got arrested was quite amazing, and it gave us an opportunity to speak to human beings, to look at those 30-some agents and see them as human beings, people with the potential to hear. They didn't want to hear, but when they came to our home, they saw that this was not some drug pen, and it's just people. And when you speak to people as human beings, Ram Dass says, see, everybody is a soul, you know, whatever that means to you. Some people say, look at people naked, but if you look at every individual with the same potential as you have, there's there are two things that happen. One is they don't, the law enforcement, the them, whoever they are, doesn't see you as the enemy, doesn't see you as a criminal, because you're not. And the other thing is that there's a kind of equanimity that begins to be built. And we can speak to one another in ways that we have not perhaps spoken before. When I was in Congress, I went up to a couple of the DEA agents, and, you know, I was saying, it's so silly that, you know, I work with people who are dying, and you want to protect people. So why do we call each other enemies? You know, I mean, it's a foolishness. We're not enemies, and we have to really work. We've really got to work this out, because it doesn't look good for you to keep coming and busting people who are dying, and it isn't good for us either. So how do we, you know, you're here defending something, but how do we work together to change it? Well, I don't think that they necessarily want to work with me, but directly, because they really can't, and we're suing them, so, you know, we're not supposed to have a great number of conversations. But the point is this, the point is that if we can create the dialogue in the moment, that can take us further than the moment. It'll take us beyond, it takes us beyond what's happening. It takes us beyond only what appears to be happening, and it changes minds, because one of the agents that day said, I'm thinking about getting another job sometime soon. One out of 30 DEA agents, that's not bad. You know, one agent at a time.
Righto, Valerie. Also, one more question today, because you mentioned this broader issue of healthcare in America. It's an issue we're all struggling with, really. I mean, Michael Moore is making documentaries about it. The presidential candidates in both parties are talking about it. But do you think that medical cannabis and a change on this issue more broadly in the country could also be an important starting point to changing our system of healthcare in this country overall?
I have to say that that's a wonderful question. And yes, it can be, because it's an enlightenment, kind of the re-enlightenment of calling back the herbal remedies. We don't want to replace the pharmacopoeia. We want to add to it. We want to add back to it the folk remedies, the remedies that grow in the gardens that were once available to us, and to create an awareness of the way that people can help each other by working together and for themselves to supply medicine very inexpensively and at no cost. Now, I know the insurance companies don't like this, but we don't really care what the insurance companies like. They don't like people either. They like illness, because they figure that by controlling access to medicine and our health care, that they will keep us locked into a system that represses health. However, that's if we become more in touch with how we feed ourselves, how we clothe ourselves, how that impacts the planet that we live on, what we grow for our own wellness or to supplement wellness, then it empowers individuals. Really, you know, you can look at Spain, for instance, and say, after Franco, what has happened? Instead of repression, like after Mao Zedong in China, what has happened? You know, instead of repression, the Spanish have come with some of the greatest forward-thinking freedoms, and those freedoms include access to health care, to art, to music, to the fine things in life, to walking, to public transit. People walk everywhere there, so they're healthier. They're thin. You don't see what you see here, the mass quantity of body. Is that bad, wrong? No, it's just not healthy. We become more in touch with our own wellness by paying attention to our own care and what we put in our bodies and how we do that. I mean, people can grow tomatoes, but they go to the market. Why is that? I don't think that anyone has to worry about us growing marijuana and not keeping the market supplied. There'd be a great market for that, taxes. There'd be a really great market, and folks would have more taxes would be paid, and we'd have more access to better things. I mean, I think we need to look at our country, recognize its repressive nature, and curb that, heal it, take the time to heal it. And that's going to take a lot of work. It means that maybe some of us have to wait for a bus. Oh, God forbid, there wouldn't be one person in every car. But, I mean, that's kind of what's fair that's happening. Gas prices are going up. What are on the tips of people's tongue? Is it the gas prices, or is it the murder and slaughter and genocide that's occurring in Iraq? And what's really our greatest concern? Health means not only my health, but your health and the health of our planet, as well as the health of our incredible and remarkable nation. In a nation that gives me the opportunity to sue the federal government, that provides that possibility, and keeps me still out of jail, and growing medicine together with my friends, with my husband Mike's agricultural genius and adeptness, and you know, speaking out against an injustice. So we, you know, we're on the verge of change, but it's harder than ever, because it's really up to us. And the 60s, we failed to, you know, buy all the television stations and give away the profits. Really, what we should have done, we blew it. We need to not drop out, but take over. And you know, by speaking the truth, because we have no access to media anymore, except thank goodness for you, for the stations who are speaking it, We need to keep doing what you're doing, taking over, providing opportunity for another form of truth.
Well, Valerie, this has truly been a wonderful conversation here today. I just so appreciate you taking time to join us here on the Audio Stash, and I'm looking forward to seeing you down there in Texas on Friday.
Oh, I'm just so pleased. What a great opportunity, and thank you for helping to provide it and to provide a voice for people just like you and me. All of us the same, really.
Valerie Corral is the co-founder and director of WAM, the Women's Alliance for Medical Marijuana. They're one of the beneficiaries of the Austin Freedom Fest on Friday. We have links to their website at normalaudiostash.com. Listening to Normal's Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Make sure you visit our website at normalaudiostash.com. That's normalaudiostash.com for more information about every day's show. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Thanks for listening today. See you at 4:20 tomorrow. Podcasting technology of Normal is made possible by Red Aphid Interactive Media. More information at redaphid.com.